We, in a way, had everything wrong except it. On the surface of what we did was just, it was just so wrong. It looked wrong, these were the wrong subjects, but underneath it all, there was something that was ringing true.
I think what's important is that you are on top of your game, and I think we are. I think this is our moment, and that's unusual for a band who've been around for so long, but this is our time now.
On the release of their 11th album, All That You Can't Leave Behind, Bono announced to the audience at the London Astoria that U2 were reapplying for the job of best band in the world. And as the Elevation Tour arrives in the UK, having crossed America and Europe, it looks like, after nearly 25 years together, U2 are indeed back on top. I'm Simon Mayo, and over the next 2 weeks, Bono, The Edge, Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen reflect on the extraordinary highs and lows of their band in the U2 story. It all started, rather famously, at school. As teenagers, the future members of U2 met and were nurtured at a unique academy. Mount Temple High School was founded in the early 70s on the north side of Dublin. It welcomed students from different religious backgrounds and social classes. Bono's mother was Protestant and his dad Roman Catholic. In Ireland, this was a marriage outside of the usual tribal loyalties. Edge's parents were from Llanelli. Adam Clayton's father was a former RAF pilot and his mum an air hostess. He was born in Oxfordshire. Larry Mullen, born and bred in Dublin, was the youngest of the four. As The Edge and Larry recall, Mount Temple was the only place in town that could have brought together such a mix of characters.
Everybody was quite optimistic and positive, not just the kids, but also the teachers and the whole kind of administrative side of the school, because it was like the beginning of Ireland's equivalent of the comprehensive system, where schools were more community-centred rather than religiously based. So it was more of a melting pot in terms of religious background, but also social background. There was every kind of strata of North Dublin society sent their kids to this school.
There were very wealthy people, there were middle class people, and there were those who were from sort of housing estates, you know, people who were living in, you know, sort of some of the projects. So it was a total mixture of people, and that's what was unusual about it.
The young Larry Mullen had immersed himself in drumming and music theory and had ambitions to take his skills further. Encouraged by his father, he decided to try and find other like-minded souls by sticking a message on the school notice board. At this stage, Bono was still known as Paul Hewson, and he applied for the position of guitarist in Larry's band. So did Dave Evans, later to become The Edge. Dave's brother Dick brought along his homemade guitar, and the pair tried to get by on their basic gear. Adam Clayton had an amp and a bass guitar, and he bluffed his way with some musicianly language. They called themselves Feedback, and as The Edge recalls, they weren't particularly great.
That was really the name we gave ourselves, because that was the predominant sound of any of our rehearsals, was the squealing feedback. As four of us would try and plug into the same amplifier, including Bono's microphone. And in fact, for about a year and a half, we never made it to the end of a song. We'd always get about a minute and a half in, and just the sheer strain of trying to keep going was too much for us, and we'd stop. The height of our achievement for the first year or so was being able to actually hold a bar chord long enough that somebody could recognize it for what it was supposed to be. The first songs that we wrote were written really because we could not play anyone else's tunes. We were so bad that our only hope seemed to be writing something that we could get through ourselves.
Is it true you actually did Nights in White Satin?
We did an attempt at Nights in White Satin. Predominantly, the reason was that we knew a flute player, and we saw this as a great resource, that maybe if we could just find a way of putting that in. We only ever played it once. That was enough.
Feedback renamed themselves as The Hype. Dick Evans left the band as his brother became good enough to cover as the sole guitarist. Early in 1978, a musician friend called Steve Averill suggested that they chose another new name, U2. The band were friends with some characters from the Cedarwood Road area of Dublin, where Bono lived. people like Gavin Friday, who had become the lead singer with the Virgin Prunes, a provocative, theatrical act. They had a name for their loose collective, Lipton Village, and, as The Edge explains, new names for each other, too.
Most rock and roll bands are like street gangs, and we actually had a kind of a street gang that was the social structure of, out of which came a couple of different groups, U2 being one and the Virgin Prunes being another. And part of the creativity of that that particular gang, which we loosely called Lipton Village, was name-giving. Such exotic names as Cushy Butterfield was one particular character I remember. Or the Jam Jar was another character. Apparently I was given Edge because of my chin. That was what it was all about. And Bono was called Bono because he just looked like the sound of the word Bono. Quite powerfully built fella.
We used to put on mad performances in Grafton Street. You know, we'd bring on the bus, we'd bring like a stepladder and electric drills and stuff, and just put on these mad performances. And one day we met this character called Mannix Flynn, and he said, you know, if you are going to get into being on a stage, you have to know what to do with yourself on a stage. You have to learn how to be unselfconscious. You have to learn how to do it. You should learn mime. And we said, well, will you teach us? And for a year, I guess, we studied mime under Mannix Flynn. Now, this was not some sort of effete artiste type. This was like a rough geezer, and I think, in a way, was responsible for some of the confrontational way that I perform.
In March 1978, U2 entered and won a talent contest in Limerick. They took home £500 and the chance to audition for the Irish division of the CBS label. The company's representative at the Limerick show was Jackie Hayden.
They were like nothing that I was used to hearing on the Irish music scene at the time. I suppose at that time, most bands were either influenced by the whole punk thing or glam rock or maybe heavy metal a la Black Sabbath or Led Zeppelin or whatever. U2 seemed to come out of nowhere, and they had incredible stage presence, even though the sound wasn't particularly good. They just struck me as a band that you really didn't know where they'd come from, and perhaps more interestingly, you didn't know where they were going to go.
A local music writer, Bill Graham, was also enthused. He praised the band in a series of features in the Dublin music magazine Hot Press, lent them records and books, and encouraged them to be different. Adam Clayton, who had taken on the role of U2's manager in those early days, remembers the significance of his support.
Bill was a very, very kind of unique journalist because although he was a great supporter of what was happening locally in Dublin and Ireland, he also, you know, was very stimulated and excited about what radical musical changes were happening anywhere else in the world, particularly in London or, you know, America. And early on, we went to him with the problem, which was we needed a real manager. We needed someone who could fight our battles for us and someone who could be critical of how we were approaching things and what we were doing. And, you know, he came up with the suggestion of Paul McGuinness. And without that suggestion, I think it would have been a very different story.
Paul McGuinness was an old college friend of Bill Graham's who was trying to make his way in the film business. He'd had some previous experience with groups and had been quietly searching for a talented baby band.
They were doing then badly everything they now do very well. They weren't particularly good at their instruments and Bono wasn't a particularly good singer, but the idea of the band was absolutely formed and they were standing in the same positions as they now stand on stage and they kind of looked like they look now and the commitment to performance was there. Bono was very unlike the other singers of the time in that he would run around the front of the stage hunting for eye contact with the audience. He was a very charismatic performer right from the start. It was always very clear that U2 was going to be a rock band consisting of the primary colours of rock and roll, guitar, bass, drums and a singer. I thought of them like The Who, like Led Zeppelin, and I thought they would be one of the biggest bands of all time.
CBS Ireland was the first record company to commit to the group. U2-3 was the title of the band's first single, released in September 1979. It featured the tracks Stories for Boys, Boy Girl, and Out of Control.
When you're a very young group, making a record is kind of so unobtainable as an idea that in itself, is, as far as you're concerned, that is making it. If you've made a record, that's it. So I remember the first time I held a copy of our CBS Ireland 12-inch, which was Out of Control and Stories for Boys and Boy Girl, thinking, well, is this it? Like, this is, we've done it. We've arrived. We've made a record. We finally did what we'd set out to do years before. But on another level, I was almost instantly filled with a sense that this is like just the beginning. I want to do this again. I want it to be a much better record. And so it was kind of when we started to get serious, really, was when we had our first single out.
U2 were gradually building an audience in Dublin, notably at a series of Saturday shows in the city's Dandelion Market. The do-it-yourself attitude of punk had arrived, a feeling that anything was possible. A new national pop radio station had been set up in Ireland. Hot Press provided useful advice for fledgling bands and helped to spread the word. And other Dublin bands like the Boomtown Rats and Thin Lizzy had made it big.
You could kind of kid yourself that, you know, because you played your instruments badly and you had attitude, that you were part of this brotherhood of punk that actually had nothing to do with being in Dublin. It was much more about, could you get the ferry to London and be a part of it? And you could kid yourself because, you know, the Boomtown Rats had come out of Dublin and they'd gone on to make records and have record deals and be in the English press. And Thin Lizzy had managed to do it. And another band called the Radiators from Space. And I think at that point, probably a couple of northern bands had kind of just got enough reaction happening and enough interest from the UK that you could kind of feel the breath of punk in Dublin.
But like many bands, U2 found it difficult to secure a long-term record deal. CBS Ireland was unable to excite its counterparts in London. The band decided to take a financial risk by booking the 1,200-capacity National Stadium in Dublin for a show in February 1980. They pulled a good, keen crowd, and their potential was obvious. Island Records offered them a deal right after the show. Their first UK release was the single 11 O'Clock, Tick Tock. Significantly, the producer was Martin Hannett, who'd made his reputation with Manchester band Joy Division. U2 were clearly fans.
We were such sponges as a young band, creatively. You know, we would take in everything that was going out there that caught our eye. We would just instantly become part of what we were doing. Listening back to the first couple of records, it's amazing to me to hear those influences coming back so clearly. I can hear Susie and the Banshees, I can hear some of the Clash, I can hear Patti Smith and even a bit of Television, but I can also hear Joy Division in there. And those were the bands that really we were so influenced by at the time, and yet we didn't fully even realise how big an influence they were.
But with the death of Joy Division lead singer Ian Curtis, Martin Hannett was no longer available to work with the band. U2 turned instead to Steve Lillywhite.
I think Martin Hannett decided, you know, he wanted some time off or something like that. So U2 had to find someone else, and I was their second choice, really. So I got this call and, you know, I was, go over and see the band live, you'll be picked up by a Mr. McGuinness at the airport. And I had this real feeling that there would be a bloke with sort of straw out of his hair and, you know, on a tractor to give me a lift to the gig. And I arrived at the airport and said, oh, hello, Steve. Yeah, it's Paul McGuinness here, you know. And I went, oh, well, you know. And went off to see this gig with the band, and we sat around a pub afterwards and they were drinking half pints of red lemonade shandy.
The first U2 album, Boy, was released in November 1980. A single, I Will Follow, became an instant favourite. As with many of the early songs, there was a spiritual charge in the music. But the lyric also alluded to Iris Hewson, Bono's mother, who had died of a brain hemorrhage when he was 14.
The whole first album to me was to be about loss of innocence. I didn't really know what that meant. I knew that we were gauche, and I knew that we were, even at 18, we were very, very young. We were from the suburbs, and we had had very little experience. And I will follow, I think I wrote it about, oddly enough, I mean, it's such a pompous theme, if you think, for a bunch of kids. But it was agape, love, this idea of unconditional love. And if you walk away, I will follow. The sort of love that a mother has for a child. I didn't really have that for my father, you know, because he was just a tough guy.
It was U2 policy to tour hard and often in America. They had found themselves another influential friend in Frank Barcelona, head of the Premier Talent Agency, which also had Bruce Springsteen and The Who on its books. Larry Mullen remembers those early days on the road.
When we first came to America, it was like I felt that this was kind of for real. It was no longer playing clubs in Ireland, you know, and having a single out and then making an album and then going to London. And it changed everything. All those things that you'd read about and heard about, you know, from picking up the NME, you know, and reading about, you know, the Ramones and Patti Smith and television, you know, these American bands, and we were going to go to those places and play in the same places. And you were so far away from everything you know. And it was four guys, and we didn't, I mean, we knew each other, but we didn't know each other terribly well. We were friends, but we never sort of spent time in a foreign land on our own, because we didn't have friends around. It was just us. It was kind of tough, and it was a lot of pressure, and it was scary.
There's always been a spiritual dimension to U2, and at this point in the band's career, Bono, Edge and Larry were members of Shalom, a charismatic Christian group in Dublin. They prayed, read their Bibles, and increasingly Bono was writing about his faith in his lyrics. It was a particularly intense time in the U2 camp.
Obviously, it had a very deep impact on the band. You know, Adam wasn't part of that group. It was just myself, Edge and Bono. And from being that, originally, that euphoric thing of coming together and, you know, learning about the Bible and learning about God and learning about Jesus and all this, which was amazing. There were amazing days, amazing weeks, amazing months. We did, you know, it was really quite extraordinary if you've never experienced it before, which I certainly hadn't. For all the positives, there was the negative, which was you can't. It was like the rules and regulations started to take place. The very thing that you were trying to get away from, it really tried to say to us that unless we were going to go out there and sing music or make music that was Christian music, and there was a particular genre of Christian music, that maybe we should reconsider. And we did. I think Shalom ended shortly after that.
The October album was filled with religious references, songs like Rejoice, Fire, With a Shout, and especially Gloria were clear expressions of faith.
We were trying to find sound, we were trying to find our own sound, and we were looking for that, you know, that otherness that you want, that sort of otherworldly quality, because I felt like we were too straight. And I also figured that my voice wasn't really a rock voice, and that if I tried to sing in an angry way, I just came off really badly. But I started to like a lot of the psychedelic music at the time. And I always thought of music as a sort of sacrament. I always felt it was the language of the spirit. You know, it was always a religious experience for me, music. I often wonder if as a lyricist, in fact, just as a person, if I have a, you know, that syndrome, Tourette's, where people can't control saying, sometimes it's swearing, or they just, whatever they're not supposed to say, they say it over and over and over again. I think I might be like that as a lyricist. You know, if you can't write a song about that subject, I'm going to dare to write a hymn. That was just unacceptable, so I just wanted to do it.
Outwardly, all seemed well with U2, but the October record had been produced in a fevered state. Bono's case, containing his lyrics, had been stolen from a dressing room in Portland, Oregon, so he was forced to pull together scraps of ideas and improvise on the mic. No matter, the band got their first UK hit with Fire. even if their Top of the Pops performance was so bad that the record went down the charts the following week.
We now have, from Dublin, a group called U2. It's getting a bit warm around here, gang. This is fire!
I'm Simon Mayo. This is part one of the U2 story here on 88 to 91 FM BBC Radio 2. The politics of the early 1980s were particularly turbulent. There was trouble in the Falklands, in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and South Africa. Some of the strain was reflected in the third U2 album, War. New Year's Day was a nod to the solidarity movement in Poland. Union leader Lech Wałęsa had been agitating for better conditions. The communist authorities had declared martial law near the end of 1981. The band wrote the song, and with a lovely stroke of fortune, the restrictions were lifted in Poland on New Year's Day.
That occurred in Bono and Ali's marital home. The only way they could afford a place to live after they got married was to get the band to rent a house as a rehearsal space, and they lived in it. And I'm not fully sure who was present. I would say it was Larry Edge and myself, and we were in that house and we were jamming away, and it came out of that. You know, I think probably Larry supplied that really driving drum beat, and I think I was trying to play Fade to Grey by Visage, and it kind of came out like that.
One of the reasons we were attracted to music in the first place was that rock music was always snapping at the feet of the world and its rungs. That was the music that was turning us on. It always had, even The Who, bands that influenced you, to The Clash. Punk rock was biting, not just snapping. And so behind the music, there was always a sense of rage at the way things were.
Sunday Bloody Sunday was another of the album's most powerful songs. The title brought back memories of painful events in Irish history. But U2's lyric advocated a break from the cycle of hurt and revenge that had damaged their homeland. Bono sang, "I won't heed the battle call," and took to waving a white flag on the subsequent tour, a total dismissal of violence. Even so, some listeners took the wrong message from the song.
I didn't feel Irish till I went to America. And you found that being Irish was loaded. It had all these influences. And it made me ask questions about where I came from and what was going on 100 miles up the road in Belfast. At that stage, up to that stage, it hadn't felt like our business, like it should have been our business, like it was. And in fact, a lot of people from the north said, it isn't any of your business. But I think we're trying to contrast Easter Sunday with Sunday, Bloody Sunday, which is an incident in Derry where 13 people were shot dead by the British paratroopers, something that's still under investigation. And I think we were just trying to say, isn't this mad, these religious people fighting amongst each other, when the heart of both of their belief systems is this idea of Easter Sunday. Looking back on it now, that seems like a mad thing to try and pull off in a pop song. But oddly enough, the song has survived. And when I was doing some work at the G8 summit in Genoa, a young protester was shot on the streets there, rioting. We were playing an hour away in Turin. And that song just suddenly just came into focus.
By this time, U2 were famed for their rousing live shows. Bono was hurling himself into crowds from a height and clambering across balconies and lighting rigs completely adrenalized. Some of this drama was captured on film when the band played in the sandstone amphitheatre of Red Rocks in Denver, Colorado, struggling against rain, mud and adverse acoustics. A companion record, Under a Blood-Red Sky, captured the band live in America and Germany. In 1983, U2 visited a gallery in Chicago's River North District called the Peace Museum. The curators wanted the band to contribute towards a music exhibit called Give Peace a Chance, so they donated the backdrop to the war tour. There were two other important exhibits in the gallery. One was dedicated to civil rights leader Martin Luther King. The other was a collection of paintings by survivors of the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This latter project was called The Unforgettable Fire. The themes of the Peace Museum started to work themselves into Bono's lyrics.
The other protest, sort of agitprop bands at the time, were people like The Clash. We had huge respect for them and their music. But we wanted to find our own voice. And we became very interested in the sort of aggressive pacifism of, say, people like Martin Luther King and the kind of civil disobedience that he inspired, rather than, say, the 68 riots in Paris, which, say, had more inspired The Clash. And so we discovered a rich seam of thinking there.
When you look at tunes like a sort of Homecoming, Pride, Bad, they're deep songs. They're obviously songs that were not just scribbled on the back of a cornflakes packet. And I know that, you know, the whole civil rights issue and Martin Luther King have been incredibly inspiring to him as he juxtaposed that against, you know, how we felt about what had been going on in the North for years and how it was being dealt with and marginalised and not really taken on as an issue by men of honour.
A key development at this point in the U2 story was the arrival of producer Brian Eno. A former keyboard player with Roxy Music, Eno had distinguished himself with bold, atmospheric solo records and as producer of a series of highly influential albums by David Bowie and Talking Heads. He believed in catching spontaneous moments, in working mistakes to an artist's advantage, in using texture and depth of sound to give music extra personality. He was just what U2 wanted.
I wasn't initially very interested. I wasn't reluctant exactly, but, you know, I get quite a few invitations to produce things, and I don't think of myself primarily as a producer. So it's something I do if I, for some reason, get very interested in the prospect of doing a particular job. It's not my main job, as it were. So what happened when U2 got in touch, I didn't really know anything about them or much about their music. I'd been living in America at the time they became well known here. And so I heard a couple of things they'd done and I said, I don't really think it's the kind of thing that I can contribute much to. And then I had this long phone call with Bono. He said, look, we'd really like you to do it. And why are you reluctant about it? Or why are you finding it hard to imagine doing it? And I said, well, I know for sure that if I worked with you, the first thing I'd want to do is change a lot of the things that you're good at. I don't want to just make another record like the ones you've made before. I'd want to make something different. And he said, well, that's exactly why we asked you. And so the relationship started on that basis that my job was to sort of try to send them off in other directions or encourage them in directions that possibly the money people behind them wouldn't encourage. Because there's always a lot of impetus to sustain the momentum of a successful career by carrying on in the same direction.
Eno brought his working partner Daniel Lanois to Ireland, and before long they'd set up shop in the grand rooms of Slane Castle in County Meath. U2 were working like they'd never done before. On one legendary occasion, the group was encouraged to play naked, except for some strategically placed gaffer tape. And one song emerged as Eno slowed down a backing tape and asked Bono to improvise over the top. Thus, Elvis Presley in America was born.
In rock and roll, particularly in British rock and roll, the history of musicians who went to art school is long. Everyone, Eric Clapton, John Lennon, Pete Townsend, The Clash. We never went to art school. We went to Brian. And Brian was like our art school. He was very sort of professorial even then. He arrived looking more like an architect than an ex-member of a glam rock outfit, Roxy Music. And he arrived, you know, with a whole new book of phrases and ways of seeing music. And things like drum roll and riff and all these things were thrown right out in favor of treatments and sonic experimentation and it was amazing for people who had hungry ears and just actually who were just intellectually very curious. We've always been there. Brian brought a sort of rigor to our thought processes and was challenging us to think differently.
As the band set out to tour The Unforgettable Fire in America, Rolling Stone ran a cover story declaring U2 to be the band of the 80s. But it was another bigger event that effectively crowned them. At the end of 1984, Bono had added his vocals to the Band Aid charity single Do They Know It's Christmas? Bob Geldof had started the project aimed at raising money for Ethiopian famine relief. The transatlantic concert, Live Aid, followed on July the 13th, 1985, and was beamed to more than 1.5 billion television viewers worldwide. U2 took part from the stage of Wembley Stadium and closed their set with a fierce version of the song Bad. Against Live Aid directions, Bono dived into the crowd and eventually emerged dancing with a girl from the audience. To the band's surprise, its performance would prove to be one of the highlights of the show. If you twist and
turn away. I think we were all a bit nervous, and that translated into a slightly hyper performance. And Bono sort of went into the crowd as he had done before on a couple of occasions, but he really went into one in this case and was like down there in the pit, and he was trying to make connection with members of the crowd in the front. And it all seemed to be going a bit wrong.
There was a three-light system on the stage. Green, you were fine. Orange, you'd got a couple of minutes, you'd better finish. Red, bye-bye, you were gone. The stage was turning, and the stage turned, you know, to get people on and off. He kept this vibe going, was, you know, doing his thing, embracing the girl, dancing with her. And then suddenly their lights started going, and the roadies were signalling, you know, get off, finish the song. So they finished and say thank you, but they were supposed to do three songs. And when they came off, they thought they'd blown their career. They'd absolutely thought that that was it, that it was a total and utter disaster. Of course, completely contrary to what everybody else watching it thought.
We were completely surprised when all over the world people started ringing in saying U2 is their favourite thing. Or, I think it was between us and Queen. I mean, we were already breaking America at that stage. I think it helped us along the way instead of hurting us. I think after that, though, I do remember some criticism that are U2 and their ilk, are these bands marketing idealism? And that's an interesting question, because I suppose yes is the answer.
In 1986, U2 became directly associated with issue politics and matters of global conscience. After celebrating the 25th birthday of Amnesty International, they set off on a tour across America under the banner A Conspiracy of Hope, alongside the likes of Lou Reed, Peter Gabriel, Sting, Joan Baez and the Neville Brothers. They were highlighting the Amnesty cause, helping the organization's membership to triple and raising $4 million. U2 were by now a massive international act, but things were about to get even bigger.
In the UK in the middle 80s was a kind of annoyance, actually, that U2 were making it in America, where so many great British talents had originally scored, but where our contemporaries were missing. And I was trying to justify this by saying that this is a subject. Forget just the place. America is a subject you can't ignore. And I suppose as Irish people, we had a different relationship with America. To us, America was kind of a promised land. It's, you know, so many Irish people had gone there. In fact, it's 49 million people in America who call themselves Irish, much more than living in Ireland. So I read a line by Wim Wenders that America had colonized our unconscious. And I thought that's really true. And whilst I admired songwriters in Britain who were focusing on the local, in a way as a defense against this kind of barrage of America, I said, I want to take on that subject. You know, we've been traveling through America and the poetry of the place names and, you know, songs just falling off the tops of buildings there. So we became, on the Joshua Tree, kind of both fans and critics of America. I started getting into Miles Davis, started getting into jazz, started listening to Willie Nelson, started reading American writers and playwrights like Sam Shepard. And his screenplay for Paris, Texas was a brilliant image. He had stumbled upon a brilliant image for the sort of parched climate of the 80s, spiritually in America. I forget the name of the character that Harry Dean Stanton plays, but in Paris, Texas, he's just walking through the desert. So I took this desert theme and went down the road with it musically.
The Joshua Tree album was released in March 1987. It topped the charts in Britain and America, creating new sales records in the process. In a short space of time, the record sold 12 million copies. The Joshua Tree was more song-based than ever, frequently exultant and uplifting.
There was something about that record kind of right from the start. We were renting a house and we'd set up the rehearsal space in this room that just had a certain kind of feeling and it had a definite sonic identity. And I think because there was this sort of preoccupation with things that were kind of American, and it was only in a way later when the themes were really tied down, but the idea of just playing together in that room and it being kind of raw sounding. And Bono was kind of singing the best he'd ever sung at that point, and the songwriting was disciplined. It just felt right.
The record sounded confident and controlled, but the recordings had witnessed the usual degree of chaos, last-minute changes, and indecision. Where the Streets Have No Name had been worked at so much that the master tape was wearing out. Brian Eno, in a fit of impatience and anger, had to be restrained from wiping the tape completely.
That song was a great song from the moment it was born. So the first 15 seconds of that song's existence, it was there, really. It was always there. And it was worked on, I would say, 40 or 50% of the time we spent on that album was spent on that one song. But it got worked on in what I thought was a very cautious way. So the very first recording of it was quite good, but the bass wasn't right. The guitar wasn't right, so we replaced those. Then the drummer decided the drums weren't right, so we replaced those. Then the bass needed replacing again to work. And we were constantly doing this thing of, you know, it was like Abraham Lincoln's axe, where the head has been replaced four times and the handle six times sort of thing. And I thought, why don't we just start again? You know, we know this damn song so well. What are we actually hanging on to now? We haven't got a single original instrument. There's no sense of a band performing any longer. So why don't we just start again? But I knew we wouldn't if we still had that master tape around, because so much time had been invested in that particular recording of it. So I thought, we'll have an accident.
I can't tell you how exciting it was to be a bunch of Paddies now travelling by limo through America on the cover of Time magazine and having a couple of number ones in a row. It was madness for us. I mean, it was just kind of a wild daydream. And to have somebody like Bob Dylan turn up at a gig and you ask him, does he want to come on stage and do his thing? He says, sure. And, you know, you're sitting back talking with Bob Dylan afterwards and he says, you know, all this madness that you're going through right now. And we said, yeah, I went through this on my own. He said, I always wanted to be in a band, is the truth. It makes it so much easier. And I could see right then the riches of what we had as a band, the strength that it gives you, because it is intoxicating to be moving at that speed. There is a certain G-force that distorts your face and your spirit, just everything. But it was really exciting.
With the Joshua Tree a success around the world, the band hit the road, playing to over 3 million fans in 264 days. The movie director, Phil Joanneau, was following the action. This appeared in 1988 as Rattle and Hum, the film, the album, and the book. U2 were captured live in Dublin, Memphis, Los Angeles, and Denver. They were paying tribute to the music of Elvis, Dylan, Lennon and Hendrix. Bono said the film was like Apocalypse Now without so many helicopters. But the critics weren't impressed.
It so annoyed Americans because what was supposed to be a homage by some fans to the rich weave that is American music looked like the opposite. It looked like we were trying to cast ourselves among the greats. The hype that went with the movie just was too much for people to take at that point. They just had enough of YouTube right then.
There were a couple of key songs in there that I liked. I liked God Part 2. I liked All I Want Is You. Hawk Moon, Heartland were all great U2 songs. And the songs that people seemed to have difficulty with were When Love Comes to Town, Angel of Harlem, and Love Rescue Me. And of those songs, Angel of Harlem is a fantastic song. And we had our first number one single with Desire. So I think it was a great record.
U2 finished the decade with the Lovetown Tour, supported by B.B. King. After dates in Australia, New Zealand and Japan, they came back to Dublin, playing four shows at the Point Depot. The last show was New Year's Eve, 1989. Over the course of these final shows, Bono kept dropping hints that a change was coming. U2 started the 80s without a proper record deal. At the end of the decade, they were the biggest rock and roll band in the world. And they were getting ready for the 90s and a different set of challenges. Hello Berlin, Achtung Baby, and the guy with the fly shades.
You realise the force of the media, how quick and easy it is to become a caricature, how you lose all detail and tone, and how your life just becomes comedy really quickly. And so we decided, well, if caricatures are part of the life of being, in the media and making music, let's have some fun with our caricatures. Let's come up with some of our own. Enter the fly and Acting Baby.
Elevation, part two of the U2 story. Next Saturday evening at 8 o'clock, here on 88 to 91 FM, BBC Radio 2.